There's a lovely poem by William Stafford inspired by the childhood game Rock, Paper, Scissors, the one in which, at the count of three, the players make shapes with their hands. Rock beats scissors, scissors beat paper, and paper beats rock, and so on. Stafford titles his poem Stone, Paper, Scissors, and he writes, "Stone, you put your hand on stone for the coolness there, and how steady. It hasn't the wit of water, but you trust it more. It will be there again tomorrow, earning its place by not being anything else. Paper. Paper is always ready. Where shall we go? Anywhere. It will cover stone, but it has no principles. It seems agreeable, but it may be guiding you just by being so flat and letting you relax all the time. Scissors? Scissors, that's different. It breaks on rock, but it knows exactly where paper goes, and it bites right where paper is. And it closes its mouth on the truth, making it into many. Scissors, paper, stone, how are they like us? What do they show? Each of them needs a friend." Words of William Stafford from his poem Stone, Paper, Scissors, inspired by the game so many of us played as children, where there are almost always winners and losers, rocks set against scissors, scissors set against paper, and so on. Not so for William Stafford. He encounters each of these items, these elements, and observes them in their essence and closes the poem with their need for each other, and so for us, as different as we are. And we should hold on to those thoughts as we enter into a conversation with two artists who work very differently. One who works with paper, the other with stone and the like. The one who works with paper uses scalpels rather than scissors, but the comparison here is the same. And we might also hold on to the notion of playing a game. We'll find, in fact, that the artist's conversation here will end with an invitation from one to the other to come and play. Art educator Jennifer Iserman believes an artwork presents the opportunity for us to play, or the meeting place for conversation. The work of art will define the boundaries and the rules of conduct, like rock, paper, scissors. Hence, although no two viewers may play within the same space in exactly the same way, there are right ways to play. There are also wrong ways. Similarly, with a conversation, no two discussions of a given topic will exactly replicate one another. Different subject matter emerges, and we draw different conclusions. Despite the differences, a conversation about apples and oranges is about fruit, and one about steel and concrete is about building materials. It's difficult to confuse the two. Viewers of art come to understand one work differently from another. However, we can recognize in all these understandings a conversation on a common topic. We can identify a common play space. Paul Plumador and David Green paid a visit to the WVIA Benko studio in connection with their joint exhibition titled Fractured and Natural Forms at the Circle Center for the Arts, where, even if the viewers are quietly observing these forms, the images are chattering with each other in intriguing conversations, drawing the viewers into the dialogue. What's special is that Paul and David actually engaged in a conversation themselves in the course of their visit here to the Benko studio, embodying the activity that their images are involved in at the Circle Center. First, Paul. How did it come about? Did you know each other?
We did not know each other.
No.
And it's because of Allison Maslow. I think she'd already
she and Margie Bryan were working with you.
Yes. On a show, and these were all on pedestals, and so there were walls available. And Ryan Ward, who works up at Marywood, were friends, and I guess they were talking, and he recommended me, and she calls me and says, it's short notice, but can you fill up the walls? And I was like, sure.
It worked well.
And the title is?
Fractured in Natural
in
Forms.
Natural Forms, yes.
And of course, he's natural. I'm fractured. But she had a lot of foresight, I think, to put those two things together because they're not obviously related.
No.
But they bounce off each other in a really nice way.
And the poster or the invitation card demonstrates that beautifully, the way the images talk to
yes.
each other. Did you go in and put your pieces on the pedestal and then you, Paul, how did the hanging, quote unquote, go?
Well, that was Margie Bryant and Alison Maslow who put all of that together, and they did a beautiful job. First, you delivered your work that was around the walls, and then they hung your work first.
Did they? I wasn't
they
there.
Did.
I just
right.
delivered, and I let them take it from there.
Which was a perfect way to do it. And that way, when we put up the sculpture, there was no moving of any sculpture. I helped. I put them where she told me to put them in such a way that worked as well as possible with your work.
And you felt that at the opening? When you were there at the opening, you could go, aha?
Yes. Right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess it, I don't know whether Alison or Margie played a stronger role in it, but I think it was Allison's eye, basically, and she has a real, she put, even my own work, she put things together in ways that I wouldn't have thought to. And it was like, oh, yeah, it was like an aha, oh, very smart. So, yeah, she has a wonderful eye, and I thought it just kind of had a choreography to it.
And that's a key word for you, choreography.
Yeah.
We'll get to that.
Cue the choreography.
Let's talk a little bit now about individual paths. You're not from northeastern Pennsylvania, but you've made it your home, Paul. For how long?
Well, I've been a weekender. I was a weekender here since the mid-'80s and moved up here permanently in 2013.
And looking way back, you have been a dancer.
Yes. I started at age 7 and informed my parents at age 7 that this is what I was going to do after one tap dancing lesson. And I did. I went to New York and NYU and studied at the School of the Arts, and then became, actually I taught at the School of the Arts after I graduated. And then from there I fell into the Paul Taylor Company and I toured the world. And then one day I just said, great, enough. 21 years was enough. So I stopped.
The last time we spoke, Paul, was a long, long time ago, but I have in my memory your mentioning lamps and shades and old objects.
I think what you're remembering is that when I left dance, I fell into antiques and was an antique dealer and did shows on the road and then graduated from there into kind of switched sides of the table and became a manager of a very large antique emporium in New York City with my partner, Jim. That's what I was doing at the time when I retired and came up here full time.
In fact, the last time you were here, we were talking about the paper cut creations that you were making.
Well, actually, I started doing those back in the 70s. I've been doing those for 50 years. I had a short career as an illustrator. I didn't like being told what I had to do, so I stopped that for a while. Then I got back into doing it, but just for myself. And when I retired, I did a show called the Northeast Biennial, and I sold pieces, and I was awarded a solo show at AFA. And so from there, I said, oh, well, then now I know what my retirement's going to be, and I've been making art ever since.
David, what about you and stone and marble and clay and all those things that might have played a role when you were a little guy?
When I was young, 18 or so, I started getting more and more interested in art and art history. My grandmother was an artist. I had a chance to go to art museums in Detroit, and that, as a kid, I was dragged around to museums. And this was in Connecticut when I first started, and I was about probably in my 20s by the time I turned to sculpture. And it was just kind of an odd thing. I saw a rock in the backyard, and I got myself a star drill and started banging on it, dulled the drill, didn't do anything to the rock. And I thought, oh, this is pretty cool. I got to find out how this is done. And then I switched tools and materials in order. And then it just went from there. It was, there's kind of an old thing about playing the tuba. Nobody really wants play the tuba. It's, you have to play the tuba. And this is my tuba.
And when you would go to the museums, what caught your eye in terms of sculptural pieces or are paintings on the wall?
Paintings on the wall never gave me the kind of visceral excitement that three-dimensional work did. There's just a feeling in my chest and stomach when I see something that I really respond to. There's an excitement there. And I work through models and things like that. And when I get to a point where I feel, in my own terms, I feel an idea is picking up speed, and I begin to get that feeling inside, that I know that I've got an idea that deserves to live.
Then what? Henry Moore, Rodin, Michelangelo?
Oh, all of the above. Saint-Gaudens, Michelangelo, Rodin, Brancusi, Max Bill, a whole litany of artists.
And what became, at least at first, most congenial in terms of getting the right tools and having an impact on a medium? You were saying that you dulled the drill and nothing happened with a stone. What did you find at first that worked for you?
Well, I took it right up to the Vermont Marble Company and bought some stone, and then bought a couple of chisels and started to go from there. I worked for 25 years with just hammer and chisel, no carbide powered tools. I mean, drills and grinders and things were among my tools back then. But basically, the bulk of the work was all done by hand. And that gave me a really good, solid background. And then when I graduated to compressor and air hammers and things like that, it was much more exciting because you could move through a lot of material and get to an end of an idea much more quickly.
Paul, you had a question, David.
I did. How'd you know that? Yes. Did you study?
Did you train? But not in school. I have a huge library of art books.
But I mean, in terms of technique, of cutting
I
stone.
I never went to school and never found another stone carver.
Wow. That's incredible.
Well, yeah, it's the slow way to do it. I don't recommend it. But it gives you a certain amount of freedom in finding your own mistakes and finding the avenue.
Pieces you have in the show, I'm curious, are most of those done by hand, or were those, did you use like machines?
I always use, it's all by hand. When you're using an air hammer, it's all by hand as
but
well.
But it's not like,
it's not just
like
a
Michelangelo.
Blow by blow hand. I mean, the air hammer I've always been a purist, but the air hammers have been around since the 1890s. Doing anything good by being a purist, you're just being slow.
And Paul asked the question about how David looks at a stone and does like Michelangelo. Oh, the form is there. I just have to tap into it.
Yes, so what I wonder is do you have an idea and you look for a stone that fits the idea, or do you find a stone and the stone gives you an idea? I know there's graining in the stone, and so right. I'm assuming that sometimes artists follow that grain and it creates the form, especially yours, which you sometimes get very abstract.
Yes, right.
And so I'm just wondering how that works.
In stone, every time you remove something, you remove an option. So if you don't go in with a plan, this is my own personal feeling, and other people feel completely different about that. In fact, I heard one sculptor say that the first thing you do is knock away 30% of the stone, and then you begin to find something in it. And to me, that means that you've knocked out 30% of the possibility of the stone in terms of gesture or what you want to do. So I like to start with an idea. And I'll start an idea on paper, or typically what I do is, I'm being a three-dimensional guy, I work in clay or wax and develop my ideas in three dimensions. And that way I get a chance to spin it. And sometimes it's difficult when you're drawing on paper to get a clear image of what it looks like from the side of the back. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can do it, but it's just a little more awkward.
Yeah.
So you can solve some of the design problems, or you make innovations pretty quickly and easily in clay. And usually I don't work much more than 8 inches, 10 inches tall when I'm doing that quickly. And then I'm very, very careful when I'm lofting that into the block with careful drawings on different sides, and then I'll cut away that. But I get to a point where I've gotten the essence of my idea into the block, and I can see it more clearly. Then I put aside the model and those things, and then it becomes itself. You know, then it leads you down certain paths. And
that's what I was wondering about. Yeah.
And the thing is that the color and scale always make changes in an idea. So something black looks thin, something white looks heavy.
And does the stone itself lead you places you didn't
Absolutely.
Expect because of where it's grained? Or
I spend a lot of time searching out the stones that I pick up, that I buy. When I buy alabaster, it comes in boulders. Marble comes in blocks. With the boulders, it's a little bit more freeing and all of that. But I typically follow the idea I've got in my head, as opposed to try to discover an idea in the stone.
In the stone.
Because it's so slow, you know, so painfully slow at times. Each blow is kind of tentative. If you know where you're going, you can get there much more quickly.
I know with my work, I sometimes will have something go wrong with the way I cut or the paper tears or
right.
something. So I've tried to learn to take those things instead of crumpling it up and swearing. I've learned how to say, okay, this is the universe speaking to me in a way that I need to follow. Does that right. happen in the stone? Like, do
it
you
does.
Sometimes go, oh, man, I just hit that too hard? Or, you know, things can happen when you're
things
working.
Things can happen, and also I can fall out of love with an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll put it aside. And eventually something will come from that, and hopefully an improvement.
Usually it can be an improvement if you,
yes,
if
right.
you decide and, to embrace
yeah.
it.
And there are times when I'll go back into an older piece and just do some editing and that kind of thing, and I'm not afraid to do that, but it's usually pretty well planned out what mm-hmm. I do, and that's strictly for convenience on my part, you know.
You were saying, Paul, that some of the pieces of sculpture are more abstract. Do you tend to like to do figures or torsos?
Yes, I do, very much. And again, a lot of my work is abstract. I like to feel that there's a kind of energy within each one of my pieces. And some of them are human, some of them are, you know, the just whatever figure it is has a kind of energy within itself.
Even your most abstract pieces feel very human to me in that it's like an abstraction of something human rather than just totally abstract. So
right.
I feel there's a humanity in all of them.
Like,
some are more
cool.
obvious and some are less, but they all seem to contain that human feeling.
Paul, we haven't told our listeners what it is that characterizes the work you do.
Well, I cut up old paper and reassemble it. Paper with imagery on it, printed matter. Most of it is from the late 19th century into the early 20th. Although lately I've been incorporating imagery from like the Webb telescope and stuff, so that's certainly not old. But I like combining the two. So cut and paste, I guess. I try not to call it collage. I like the word montage better because it seems to fit what I do. People have a preconceived idea about what collage is. I have a preconceived idea, you know, of like theater tickets and stubs and, I don't know, matchbooks and things like that, which is fine. And a lot of times torn pieces of paper. I work with scalpel knives. Everything is very precision cuts and assemblage. And that's it. Unlike David, I don't have a preconceived idea, pretty much. Even if I do sometimes, normally I start with some image I come across that just interests me. So I'll make a cut, and then I'll see what I can put it together with, and then it leads me on. And even when I have some idea of where I think it's going, it never ends up there.
And it always seems like it's a cohesive piece.
I try. That's why I like the word montage, because in French, that actually means combining things that don't go together, so in a way that they feel like they do go together. And so that's what I'm aiming at, even though they're very surreal at times. And it's funny, I just worked for several days on a piece that I had an idea about, and I thought it was going to be just wonderful. And it's from a photograph of a very old, old lady, like 110 or something. She's so wrinkled. And I do this one series where I use multiple images and I cut them in slices and I reassemble them so they become very long and extenuated. she became so abstract that when I showed them to my partner, Jim, this morning, I said, so what do you think of this? And he was like, totally abstract. What is it? And it was like, no, you're supposed to see an old lady. So you never know. He said he liked it, though. So it is what it is, you know. I just make them, and then they are what they are. And I make a lot of art. I have portfolios just filled. And it's uneven. I will honestly say I think it's uneven. My theory is if I make a lot of it, some of it may rise to the top. And so I do. I save everything, but some of them I'll never show. And the ones I like, I frame. And that's how I do it.
Do any of your pieces suggest narratives?
Oh, definitely. I actually kind of aim to create like an image from a book that you don't know the story. So it's like if you went to a fairy tale and you ripped a page out from the middle and presented it, and then anyone looking at it would have to sort of figure out what came before and what comes after. Yeah, I like them to have a narrative, but I like people to find their own narrative in it.
Can you each choose one of your own works and tell us, for you, David, how one of your pieces interacts with Paul's and Paul's?
Well, I can answer that.
Dad, go.
Well, and again, I owe this to Allison when she set up the show. Now, I don't know the name of the piece.
Okay.
It's the wonderful woman standing. It almost looks like her dress.
That's
is
the Lady of the Lake, yeah.
The Lady of the Lake.
Yeah.
So these pieces I was telling you about that I slice up, she put all of those together and she put this Lady of the Lake right by that. And they relate so beautifully because her dress has these lines of ripples, I guess, where the wind is blowing her. Or else it's the lake. I don't know exactly.
Yeah.
But I thought they were beautifully matched.
Yeah, I have to agree.
That was one of the best.
Yeah.
Is it the Lady of the Lake, Lady of Shalott, or is it the Lady of Harvey's Lake, or is it any?
Yeah, just like, Harvey's Lake is basically it. Yeah.
Well, she's beautiful. She's like 2 feet tall, and she's very thin and wide. And she's wearing this fabulous gown, and it's just like blowing in the wind. It's just a beautiful piece.
What is her medium?
She is in a cast stone, and she came about as a, I decided to do a very clear model, and she was in clay, and I carved her in stone, and she's now in a collection in Florida. And this was one of the commission pieces that I've done in the past. She wanted a draped figure, and it was just after the hurricane, so it just seemed appropriate as Florida hurricane, you know. And so I decided I'd spent so much time exploring that idea and just getting all the draperies right and everything else that I wanted to see it. So I cast one edition in bronze, and I have since sold that one, and she's there. I mean, she's just from that casting. So I went through a whole process of silicone mold and the fiberglass mother mold and all of that. So that was an interesting process. You learn a lot of stuff just, you know.
Can you use those molds over and over?
That can be used many, many times, yeah.
So how many of her have you produced?
One in bronze and those two, yeah.
Will you do more, you think?
I may cast one in Hydrocal for myself, basically.
What about your choice? You agree with Paul on that, but do you have another pairing you might point to?
Our work is so, so different. I mean, it's not just apples and oranges. I mean, your work is very exciting, but the contrast.
Well, you have a classical approach. Some of the pieces are very classical looking to me. And in a way, I'm using sort of classical imagery at times.
Right, that's true.
Only I'm like mashing it up. But you're kind of like taking it and just sort of expanding upon it and twisting it a little bit to your own liking,
yeah.
Whereas I'm twisting it a lot. And maybe that's part of the relationship.
Yeah.
You know?
You mentioned that you saw the human in David's abstraction, but also, David, you mentioned that you feel that in each of your pieces that there is an energy in those pieces. Paul, where does the energy in your pieces come from?
I think it comes from my experience with choreography. So for me, a lot of it is about movement and like stage images. You know, when you're a choreographer, you're making pictures for the stage, but you're moving. So these are sort of like snapshots of stage images for me, a lot of them. And then again, in these wave patterns that I'm doing, I'm really trying to create motion within the figure so that you feel like a lot of them I call dancing women, you know, they feel like they're doing the shimmy or something. You know?
Two-dimensional, but you're, again, evoking an active surface. And
yes.
His work contains a great deal of energy. And I do see the choreography within your work. You know, there's beautiful balance and energy, things going on in your stuff. It's just fascinating to look at. You can just stand and be absorbed by your work.
I had a woman come up to me at the opening, and she said, David's sculptures are the perfect antidote to the irritation of your work. And then I started laughing, and she said, well, I don't mean that in a negative way. Which made me laugh
but
even
there is
more.
I mean, there is excitement in your work. It's just that energy is there.
What about music, Paul? Is that also an impulse?
I love music, and I often play music while I'm working. You probably do too.
I know? Do. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it just music helps sort of take you away, and when it's working the best for me is when I'm taken away the most, and so that's why. Unlike having an image in my head that I'm striving for, I'm more looking to let it come to me as it comes and follow it for better or worse. And you know, and then like a little bell goes off that says, oh, it's done.
It's interesting to watch you, Paul, because we know, David, you have to work with your body and you know the motion, whether it's an air hammer or not. You have to work physically. But you were just talking to us, Paul, and you were moving your hands as a dancer, no matter what. Are you all involved when you are cutting and putting and placing and moving and shaking up the surface? You must be all involved physically, even if you're still in the center.
Yes, it's a lot of hard, because it's all with hands for me. And so I have no electric tools that I can use. I'm using scalpel knives and X-Acto blades when it's a straight cut. So I'm doing a lot of kind of tight, you know, small stuff. But a couple of things. One, I've learned that it's very important to breathe. Have you learned that too?
Oh, yeah.
You know, with a cut, it's like I get a much better cut if I, while I make the cut. And so I've learned to do that. But then also sometimes I just step away from my table and I just dance around the room for a while, which loosens me up and it just feels good. I just love to move.
What are the kinds of music that might take you away? All kinds of different music?
All kinds. Although you would think, being an artist, I would be listening to the most spiritual and classical stuff, but I tend to listen to pop music. Not so much stuff on the radio, but more like really good singer-songwriters or people really dedicated to their music. But I also like to listen to ethnic music, African music, anything with a good beat, it will definitely serve me.
How about you, Dave?
It's a pretty eclectic mix. Jazz, blues, rock. It just keeps things flowing, keeps your mind going and all of that. I tend to get tunnel vision, focused hour after hour. I can sand for days and days. You know, a lot of my work is by hand with rasps. And the closer you get to the end form, the slower things go. The last eighth inch, the last quarter inch to eighth inch takes the most time.
Yeah, well, you have such beautiful surfaces. They're so, I know we're not supposed to, but I just wanted to touch things.
You just want to stroke them.
They're just
absolutely.
So, the curvature, he has these curves and this softness. It's really hard to do in stone, I would imagine. I've never worked in stone. I wouldn't know.
Well, come over and play.
No. I'd make such a mess.
Well, I do too.
Sculptor David Green and montage artist Paul Plumador speaking with us in connection with their joint show, Fractured and Natural Forms, at the Circle Center for the Arts, home of the Wyoming Valley Art League, in downtown Wilkes-Barre, 130 Rear South Franklin Street. And the show will run through August 7th, now through August 7th. For more information, on the web, WyomingValleyArtLeague.org, WyomingValleyArtLeague.org. That's Fractured and Natural Forms, featuring the work of paper artist Paul Plumador
and sculptor David Green. David Green from Luzerne County and Paul Plumador from Wayne County. And they are showing at the Circle Center for the Arts in the middle of the block. It's 130 rear South Franklin Street, and the building is a circle, so you can't miss it. WyomingValleyArtLeague.org, and the show will run through August 7th.